Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. We're in the XAP directory right now, X applications. First one in the list is Geeky, G-E-E-Q-I-E. This is an image viewer that I've used actually quite a bit at an old job. Someone had asked, I think just randomly on an internal mailing list, what image viewer should I use? Someone mentioned Geeky, and I thought to myself, you know what, I should try Geeky. And so at that job, I used Geeky quite a lot. It's quite a nice little image viewer. I think the biggest drawback for me is that the file chooser is not your system file chooser. It's got its own little file chooser, and that just sometimes that really bugs me. But I mean, it's usable. It's fine. It's a fine file chooser. It's just not the one that everything else is using, which frankly makes GwenView kind of nice. And GwenView, frankly, is a more robust image viewer than Geeky. However, Geeky is kind of truer, I guess, to what it says it is, which is an image viewer. That's basically all it does. You can launch Geeky from the terminal, which is how we used to do it a lot at the old job. But I don't remember the command being as complex as it is now. Maybe I'm just misremembering. Maybe I had an alias set up. I don't know. But the command is Geeky. That's again G-E-E-Q-I-E. Geeky space dash dash remote space dash dash view space path to the image. So you can't just do Geeky path to the image. You have to do dash dash remote and dash dash review in there before the image path. That launches Geeky and sends Geeky the command to view the file that you've defined. I swear I remember just typing Geeky and then the path to the image, and I can't imagine that anyone would have used this application if the command was that long. But I guess maybe just GQ-RW or RV maybe, but I don't remember that. Either way, probably more often than not, you're just going to launch Geeky. You're going to press your super key and then type GEE, and then you're going to just hit return. So that's probably what you're normally going to do. And once you've got Geeky open, you can view a specific file or a directory of files just from the file system, from your file system, using the embedded little file chooser that it has up in the upper left corner of the window. Using the plugins menu, you can launch whatever active image you're looking at in another application, such as GIMP, or GwenView, or Inkscape, and a bunch more, although not all the plugins seem to work. I was kind of playing around with some of them in preparation for this episode, and noticed that, for instance, Import from Camera doesn't, it reports that there's no camera on the computer, but there is a camera on my computer. I use this camera all the time, so that seemed weird to me. There was a image crop plugin that reports no coordinates have been defined, but I don't even see how you can define coordinates, and it doesn't tell you. So it's a bit weird. Some of the plugins might be specific to, I don't know, processes that I guess I'm just not privy to. But I think the real star of Geeky, combined with just it sort of being a lightweight kind of desktop generic image viewer, the real star for me is collections. And a collection in Geeky, you can create a collection from the file menu. You get a file and new collection, and then a window pops up, and it's a collection. Well, you can now drag and drop images from Geeky into that collection. Now, you're not moving the files from their location on disk. You're just adding basically a reference to that image within this collection. It's like creating a playlist in a music player. It's not rocket science. It's pretty simple stuff. But it's cool because now you can have collections of images that you want to keep together for really any arbitrary reason. Again, I guess like a playlist in a music application. So your file system might organize your photos by date because, you know, that's how your camera does it probably. But if you want to organize, or if you want to gather up just all your photos of cats, regardless of the date that the photo was taken, then you can create a cat photo collection and just drag all your cat photos into the collection. Anytime you see a cat, drag it into the collection, and now it's in the collection. It's a really basic mechanism, but it is just really, really handy to have. It's a nice visual way to gather photos together that you want to be together into one place. Now, the collections are specific to Geeky. It's a Geeky collection. It's .gqv, I think, or something like that, or C. So the collections are things that you would use in Geeky. You cannot use them elsewhere. Although I will say that the collection itself, it is just a plain text file with a bunch of file paths. So if you've created a bunch of collections and then you decide, oh, I really want my collections, but I don't want to use Geeky anymore, then you do just have a plain text list of all the photos in your collection, which I respect greatly. It's not some obtuse database thing. It's just literally file paths. Next up is GFTP, a client application to transfer files over the file transfer protocol. That is FTP. That's what GFTP is. The G stands for GTK, presumably, maybe GNU. I don't know. I've always taken it for GTK, but it's an FTP client. FTP, in case you don't know, is somewhat adjacent, or maybe even a predecessor, you could probably argue, to HTTP, but it's sort of a network-capable list and copy function. That's kind of what it feels like. So when FTP was being used widely, which it really isn't anymore, I mean, you'll still find an FTP server out there, but it's not like it used to be. But when it was being used widely, the expectation was that, for example, I would set up a server with a directory being shared with the world over the FTP protocol, meaning that my server is listening for connections over this thing called FTP. That means that you, if you've got an FTP client, could then visit my server's shared folder, and it would just take you to the shared folder. That's part of the rules of FTP, you know, and when the administrator says, I want to share this directory, that's what gets shared. And then once you're there, you can look at the files available in that directory and download whatever file you want. If I had granted write access to my shared directory, you could also upload files. That is, copy a file from your local file system over to the server. Now, allowing literally anyone to write data to your server was never not a risk, if you'll pardon the double negative. So as the internet grew in popularity, permissions tended to become constrained, and FTP itself kind of fell out of favor anyway because of the risks posed by giving strangers pretty raw access to a file system. That just tended not to be a great idea. So we don't see a whole lot of FTP anymore, and the FTP that you do see, hopefully, is technically SFTP, the FTP alike that gets funneled through SSH, because that has a lot, that's got better authentication options than FTP. FTP always just used user and password, as far as I know. And sometimes there was an anonymous option as well, which generally always had just the read permissions, never the write, hopefully. Anyway, the workflow was a little like using a file manager. That's what you can kind of imagine it as. So if you've ever used, well, a file manager, then you basically know what it's like to use FTP, except that in FTP, you point your client, GFTP, to a known FTP server. You see a list of files, and then you just drag and drop files either from one side or to the other. Now, these days, HTML browsers functionally do the same thing. I mean, they don't show you usually a literal list of files, But you do end up navigating around a website using menus and buttons, which, I mean, that's basically visiting files, right? You're not necessarily downloading them to your computer in the sense that they show up in your downloads folder, but that data has arrived at your computer, so that's you've technically downloaded that information. So GFTP is set up quite a lot like a two-panel file manager, like Midnight Commander, or like some of the modes that you'll see in like Dolphin or Conqueror or Thunar, probably. I don't know if that has a two-window mode, but there are a couple of file managers out there with sort of a two-panel view. In the left panel, in the case of GFTP, you see your own home directory with all your own files in it. That's on your computer. That hasn't gone anywhere. That's just the stuff you see on the left. In the right panel, you see the shared directory of the FTP server you've signed onto and all of its shared files. And then the idea is that you can drag from the right or the remote computer to the left, your local machine, and then you're copying a file. And then once the file is on your computer, wherever you put it, you can open a normal file manager and open up that file in whatever application would be appropriate. So that was a very useful system for a very, very long time. And frankly, it kind of still could be, right? I mean, if you wanted to share, an image with a friend, it's kind of cool to think that you could have a place on your computer where you could just put that file and then let people look at that directory and see that file. And I don't care how much we try, but I don't know that we have really gotten quite to that level of computing simplicity anymore. I mean, I don't know that it was ever there, because you'd have to be running an FTP server for that to work. So that takes a lot of you have to know how to set that up. And you'd want to set the permissions correctly and all that other stuff. But, like, it's just really, it just feels like, how many times have you been sitting right next to a person and all you want to do is beam a file over to them, and it's just always more complex than it ought to be? I mean, there are some systems that have finally, that have made it really easy, but those systems typically rely strongly on everyone being sort of on the same hardware, essentially. Like, oh, my phone has a cool feature I can just flick a file over to you and it'll just appear, and wasn't that easy? Well, no, because if your phone doesn't have that, the thing that is required to receive that file, then that doesn't work. And if it's a file type that is restricted for some reason, by some arbitrary reason, from some corporation, then that won't work, and so on. So there's a bunch of exceptions, even to the things that have worked. So FTP was quite nice for a while. I mean, it wasn't great. I'm not saying it was the greatest thing ever, but I am kind of saying that it was really nice. I don't mind it. And I guess the workflow is a little bit clunky. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to just be able to kind of preview a file right there in the FTP window? Maybe it would be. Maybe there's a client that does that. Maybe GFTP does that. I don't know. I haven't used it in a while for real life things. I've signed on to the BSD FTP server to test it. That was it. That's where HTML really did step in and kind of made it blurred the line between sharing files and showing files. And I think that's got both benefits and not, just kind of depending on what you're looking for. Next up is GIMP. It's a graphic editor. It's very, very powerful. In many ways, I think GIMP is one of the easiest arguments for what I'll call zero-knowledge tooling, by which I mean, when you show someone a photograph or an illustration or a design that you've created in GIMP, that person doesn't know whether you've used GIMP, Krita, Adobe Photoshop, Canva, or whatever else is out there on the market. it's kind of proof that tools very often, most often, do not need to be mandated, and that the cult of corporate tooling is really just based on myth. I mean, I've used GIMP since 2008, at least, for basically all of my graphic work. I mean, Krita and Inkscape get in there as well, but and you know, whatever is necessary. But I mean, GIMP has been kind of a pretty big driver. And those graphics have been published in some cases as printed ads or in magazines or on books, you know, in books or on websites. I've seen comic book artists and illustrators using GIMP for digital art. And the results in all of these cases are equal to other applications, like the output of other applications. It just doesn't matter what tool you're using to get to the end result, because the end result is this is the part that people see and care about. That's it's kind of a black box. Like the finished product has nothing to betray what it was created in. So if you think you need a specific brand attached to the software that you're using so that you can be like successful, then someone has fooled you. Now, this phenomenon admittedly isn't unique to software. I mean, in the film world, when I was in that, we used to have sort of a similar problem with cameras. Like, if I had a dollar for every time someone said to me a long time ago that they were a professional filmmaker, just because they had gone out and purchased a specific brand of camera, and yes, it was the Red, then I'd have enough money to probably finance a film. I mean, like, it's just, it was something that people would say and think all the time. It was like the tool somehow gets elevated into sort of this magic formula, and it's just not that. If you're a digital visual artist of any kind, GIMP has all the features you would expect from your tools. You know, like, that's what it does. It's a graphic editor. Now, the features might be located in a menu or a toolbar that you're just not familiar with. It might be called something different than what you're used to. Or sometimes the process of achieving a specific effect has different steps than the application that you're used to. Sometimes it's easier. Sometimes it's more complex. So sometimes it's just different, and it may or may not agree with you based on your preferred way of working. And still other times, maybe you'll just find that it's easier to duck out of GIMP really quick, use a separate tool, and then bring it back into GIMP. This is pretty standard for software in general. Things are different. Things have different, you know, different people have different ways of working and different preferences. The point is, with GIMP, you can edit photographs and images, you can create illustrations, you can use layers and effects, and you can blend and blur, add text, and everything that you'd expect. It's an image editor, and your imagination is your only limitation. So if you're thinking of doing graphic work, there is absolutely no reason not to use GIMP. Like, it's definitely a valid and suitable tool for graphic work. And I love it when I tell people about GIMP and then they sort of wander off and ignore that because it's just some weird free software that you can just get online. So it's not real, right? It's not real software. And then they end up in like a university course, illustration course or something. And the teacher has them download GIMP, what do they call it, Draw Studio or whatever it's called. It's like there are some editions of GIMP have different splash screens and kind of pitch themselves as different specialties. And then I see them using GIMP later, you know, and it's just like, well, I told you about that like months ago, but I guess because I'm just some random person, who may or may not be all that random, I guess it doesn't quite seem as believable as when like a university professor tells them. But I mean, it's funny because I used to be a teacher as well for a while at a film school, and I would tell people about a lot of tools, but somehow my advice wasn't as persuasive as the advice of the person at the Apple store or whatever. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a bad salesperson, but GIMP is really good. I mean, it's not, you know, I'm not going to say it's perfect and that it doesn't need any improvement. I mean, it needs improvement. I wish its rate of improvement was a little bit greater, although then again, I really like that when I launch GIMP, it's exactly the same GIMP that it was last year and the year before. And I think that's an important thing to consider when we say, oh, this looks like, you know, it doesn't have some fancy new feature that Photoshop has, or it does have a fancy new feature, but Photoshop doesn't have that. I wish it was more like Photoshop and less capable, which honestly is something that I've heard from some people. So it can be tricky to wish for improvement, because sometimes usually improvement means change, and sometimes you don't really want change. So I kind of value the stability of GIMP, even while I also sometimes think, oh, I wish that tool worked a little bit different or whatever. All right. So yeah, GIMP is great. And next up is GKRealm. GKRealm stands for GNU Krell Monitor, apparently. I don't think I knew that, or maybe I did. I don't know. But it's GKRELL and then M. GKRealm, or GKRealm, I guess is how I should really say it, but I heard about it first as GKRealm. So GKRealm is a system monitor. It creates a little, I think, vertical by default sort of status, a monitoring panel for your CPUs, each core, your memory, the drives that are connected to your system, network interfaces, even mailboxes, and a bunch of more other things. You can configure it to monitor all manner of devices. It's not quite, I mean, it's not infinitely flexible. There are systems that you can just custom script all kinds of things to monitor. But GKRealm has a bunch of plugins, got a bunch of modules, I guess, whatever, and you can configure them to activate. You know, you can enable different ones, and then have that on the side of your computer. I think there is a way to launch it as a horizontal bar as well, but I think I've always just kind of defaulted to vertical because that's what it defaults to. I used to run it on Fluxbox before I found some docklets that I liked, which I mentioned in the previous episode, I think. Either way, the configuration tool is graphical, so you can right-click on the title bar of GKRealm. I mean, it doesn't have window decoration, but there's a little title at the top. You can right-click there, or just, I guess, press F1, apparently, but I don't use F keys, so I don't know. And then click Configure, and then there's a bunch of different configuration options in there. Really handy if you want that sort of information at a constant rate. There's also a pretty good theming engine, so if you don't love the default look of it, which is not great probably, or at least to me it's not great. I mean, it's not horrible, but yeah, it can use a bit of a theme. You can get themes, it's no problem. You can make it look different so it fits in with your desktop. Honestly, all the monitoring that I want from my system, I can get as little widgets or plasmoids or plasmids or whatever we're calling them on KDE these days. I'm sorry, the Plasma Desktop. And then, to be perfectly honest, what I have really, really discovered is that you don't see them in the end. They sit on your desktop and they get covered by Windows and you never see them. So I don't even bother running them anymore. I used to have very reliably some system monitors set up on my desktop. And yeah, literally, like, I would either never look at them, or when I did look at them, I was discovering that I just was not taxing my system as I'd expected. And so there just wasn't enough to see, I guess, in a weird way. So I've kind of fallen off system monitors in that way. And that's okay. I mean, if I ever want it again, I'll maybe try GKRealm again. But for now, no, not something I'm feeling like I need. Let's do one more before the coffee break, and that's going to be GNU Chess. GNU Chess is a game of, as you can imagine, chess. The cool thing about it is that it has a very distinct front end and back end. So you can use GNU Chess to play chess against the computer purely in text mode. Like, you can launch it in a terminal and issue, very intuitive, issue your moves, and it'll show you a summary of the board in text, and then it'll play its turn, and then you type in your next move, and so on. It's really, really cool. And if, as I say, very intuitive. I mean, if you know enough about chess moves, you know, like e2 space e4, like, you, if you know what that means, then you can play chess in a terminal. So that's very cool. There's also a graphical mode that you can play against the computer using Xboard or eBoard. And you can also play against remote humans, actual human players, over an ICS or an Internet Chess Server. The most, I don't know if it's the most popular, but a popular ICS, at least in my world, is FICS, the Free Internet Chess Server, which I used to play on quite a bit. I haven't played chess in ages at this point, but I was into it for a while, and yeah, I used Fix, as I don't know if that's how you say it, but that's how I said it. Fix, or FICS, the Free Internet Chess Server. You can register over at freechess.org, and then you can sign in using, again, Xboard or eBoard. eBoard looks nice, and I want to like it, but I can't figure out what's wrong with it. Like, it just doesn't quite seem to work for me. Xboard, I quite like. I really like Xboard. You make your moves. It shows you kind of what that move was, so you have a visual reminder of what you've just done, what the computer's just done, or the remote player's just done. It's really quite nice. And there are save states and so on, so, you know, you don't have to, like, keep the thing running all the time. You can save your game, log back on, make a new move, and so on. So it's very cool. You can save the entire log of your game so that you can analyze it later. It's a very cool little system. I wish there was a slightly easier way to just run kind of a local, kind of a local server, really, so that you could play against someone either hyper locally, like a person sitting across the room from you, or from someone who is far away, but, you know, you've poked a hole in your firewall and assigned a IP forwarding thing to a specific, well, to your GNU Chess server, something like that. I wish that was a little easier, but apparently, and I looked into it at one point, and apparently the way to do that would be to start your own ICS with a project called LiCHess, LiCHESS. So I wish that there was a way to just go up to a menu in Xboard or to issue a command in GNU with GNU Chess and just launch a server, you know, and then there's your port number, and as long as you configure the network for people to be able to get to that server port, you're now, you know, playing chess together on just a local hosted server. But I don't know. I guess that maybe there's no point to that. Maybe just use FICS and maybe that's functionally the same with a lot less trouble. I don't know. So anyway, that's GNU Chess. It's a very cool little project, really nice. And I guess if you play chess really, really fast, you could get in a quick game over a cup of coffee. Let's go do that. Okay, we're back. I have a cup of coffee, and I have the data. I've crunched the numbers. This is one of the best cups of coffee I've had all week. I don't know what happened. It just is. Actually, all of that's fake. I mean, I do have a cup of coffee, legitimately, and it is a good cup of coffee. I don't actually have the data. I was making that part up as a segue into the next package, which is GNU Plot. GNU Plot is ancient. I mean, it's been developed since 1986. Recall that the concept of free software, of software that is shared and owned collaboratively by anyone who wants to participate, started in 1983. I should say it was formalized in 1983. Because who knows what people were doing before 83. But I mean, still, 83, GNU Plot, 1986, very early. And it has been in development ever since. So GNU Plot is a mathematical power tool for visualizing data. It has a language all its own with keywords and functions such as sine and cosine, or although they're not written out, it's sin is the function, or sin parentheses, I guess, would be the function. Cos parentheses would be another function. Bessel, BESL, I think, and so on. So it's got functions that you would find familiar if you know maths, which I don't. To get useful output, you have to learn either GNU Plot's syntax and all of its functions, you know, the language of GNU Plot, or else learn syntax for some other language or system that integrates GNU Plot output. So Julia, for instance, apparently outputs to GNU Plot if you wanted to. Octave does the same thing. So, and a lot of other things. I think LaTeX might have a module for it. So you can run into GNU Plot in lots of places that you may not even realize you're encountering it, as both a user and a well, I guess what would that be? A user and a developer or whatever, or a mathematician, I don't know. So in other words, you may have seen GNU plot output before. You probably have. If you've ever been on Wikipedia, you've probably seen GNU plot output. But also, you may use GNU plot without really realizing it in some cases. Or maybe you know you're using GNU plot, but you're not directly using it. You're using some other, gateway into GNU plot. So I read the PDF, or I read part of the PDF documentation. It's 259 pages. It's a lot to read for someone who realistically I'm not going to use GNU plot very frequently. So I can make a simple sine wave. So set key left box. Set samples, whatever you want, really. If, however, you know, whatever you think, sort of a how many sample size, you know, what sample size you want your graphic to be rendered at. Realistically, 300 is fine. You can also do, I don't know, 600, 1200. It doesn't have to be divisible by three. That's what I did. And then plot. Square bracket 0 colon 20 close square bracket. Now those are arbitrary numbers in this case. I'm just telling it to start at 0 over on the left and to go all the way to 20 over on the right. And then space sine, or in this case sin, sin, parentheses x close parentheses. So that's just calling that sine function that I mentioned earlier, that it just exists. It's part of GNU plot. You save that into a file called whatever, myplot.txt, and then run gnuplot. Gnuplot myplot.txt, and it technically plots that out. You won't know it because you won't see any output, you don't get any output. So the better thing to do is to do gnuplot space dash dash persist space myplot.txt. That plots it and illustrates it on your screen in a window, in a friendly little window. Which has a bunch of export options in the file menu. Now you can add another wave to that file by doing plot square, or rather by appending at the end of the plot line, plot square bracket 0 colon 20 close square bracket space sine parentheses x. Let's do a cosine parentheses x as well. Now if you render that or process that GNU plot dash dash persist myplot.txt, you have two waves, one a sine, one a cosine. And that's the extent. That's as far as I've gotten. There are lots of cool demos and tutorial. Well, I'm not going to say there are cool tutorials on the website. I would say that there are cool demos on the website. Maybe they accidentally are tutorials if you understand this stuff. I think GNU Plot definitely could do with maybe some more basic documentation. But then again, maybe it's wishful thinking on my part. Maybe what I'm really saying is that I would love to be better at math, which is, I mean, maybe what I'm saying, although apparently I don't care that much because I have yet to do additional math courses, although I have purchased some. Ugh, awkward. Okay, next one is gparted. This is a graphical interface for the parted command, pretty much. So that's a disk partitioner. Gparted is an application. You launch it. You have to run it as with root permissions because it can affect a disk in a potentially a negative way if you're affecting the wrong disk. It's a window that appears on your desktop, and it looks at a device. You can access other devices by, you know, in the device menu. You just click on there and see what other devices are attached to your computer, and they're listed by, you know, /dev/SDA, SDB, SDC, and so on. So you can switch over to a different drive. And once you have, then you're on that drive. That's the active drive. And if you partition that drive, then the partition table is wiped out and a new one is written to it. That can be dangerous. That's the way you lose track of data. You're not erasing the data technically, but you are removing the boundaries so that when you say, go to the beginning of the drive and look, 52 bytes from the start, well, maybe more than 52, 5,023 bytes from the start, you'll find a file that lasts for 10 megabytes, and that file is of a type it is a PNG, and so open that in some application. But without the boundaries, without the partition table to tell your computer where the beginning is, it doesn't know. It doesn't know how to find a file. It just has no way markers with which to sort of orient itself. So it's dangerous, but you do need to do it. You need to partition a drive if you're going to install most file systems. If you're going to put a file system on a drive, generally you need to partition it. That's not entirely true for everything. I think what's the UDF, I think, file system doesn't actually care about a partition map at all, but it is something that you probably should do. So if you ever need to partition a disk, you can use gparted. I personally prefer KDE partition. I think it's just called partition, KDE partition. I just think that's a slightly easier interface to kind of understand. But then again, it might just be because that's what I'm used to. And even then, you kind of have to wonder whether any of that is necessary, because, I mean, the command really is perfectly, perfectly usable. But yeah, if you wanted the graphical interface, you can do that. Neither gparted or KDE partition, I would say, is quite as user-friendly or new user-friendly as GNOME disks. If you've ever had the pleasure of using GNOME disks, then you know what I'm talking about. It's just such a nice interface. It lists all your drives on the left. You can click on them. You can kind of repartition. Yeah, I think you could fully repartition. Like, you can do a pretty complex partition table and write a file system to it. It isn't the most amazing application for options. I mean, it's a GNOME app. Give me a break. They've pared it down a lot, but it is really simple for that reason. It's pretty simple to use. I quite like that one, but I don't have that on Slackware, so I just use KDE partition, or, as I say, more often than not, just use parted, really. All right, next up is GUCARMAP. I don't know. So it's a Unicode character map and font viewer. So you launch this thing and it opens a font file, and it shows you every glyph and space without a glyph within that font. You can select the font from the toolbar and then see the glyphs in the big main panel at the bottom. You can organize what you're looking at by Unicode block or by script. But frustratingly, there doesn't seem to be a way to just see the glyphs that exist. In other words, no matter how you sort the glyphs, you always see empty spaces when a glyph is missing. Which I can see how that would be useful in lots of cases, but I think there is another use case, or at least one that I could imagine, where you just want to see the glyphs that exist in a font. And I would love it if there was just kind of a collapse function that just gave me the glyphs that are defined by a font. And the cool thing about this application is that when you find a glyph that you like, you can select it, you can click on it, and then click, it appears in the copy field. And you can select multiple things to send to the copy field. And then once you've got the glyphs that you want, you just click the copy button, and that sends it to your system clipboard, and you can paste it wherever you want. It's a really, really handy trick for getting a glyph that isn't, you know, readily available to you on your current keyboard layout or because of your input method, whatever. Really, really useful. It's just, like I say, sometimes you're scrolling through a bunch of blank spaces and you're just not even sure, like, is it over? Like, should I keep scrolling? It just feels a little bit weird and sometimes a little bit too literal. I wish there was kind of a just show me the good stuff mode. But a pretty useful little application, I would say. Next up is GV. This is, I guess, apparently based on something called Ghost View, which I don't know what that means or what that is, but I'm pretty sure it has a lot to do with Ghost Script, which, of course, is the free software implementation of PostScript, which is Adobe's language for, I think it's Adobe's, language for communicating vectors to a printer. Huge advance in printing technology when that happened. Before, you had to just render everything in a series of dots. Then, with a typewriter head, you know, whatever. You were pretty limited. PostScript could do all kinds of things, though. It could represent vectors and lots and fonts that have been designed in essentially vectors. So, yeah, the printing quality just got really, really good with PostScript. And then Adobe had to go and ruin everything by taking PostScript and bundling it into this big, big file format called PDF, which is atrocious. So GV, Ghost View, or it's really GV, but and apparently it's based on Ghost View. So GV is a PDF viewer, or actually it's a PostScript and PDF viewer. It's written to use the X11 Athena toolkit, like that XT thing that we saw in the previous directory, the X directory. So it looks and feels really, really old. Like, it feels old. It honestly does. It has confusing mouse interactions. In fact, for most of my time spent in it, for the 10 minutes that I tried the application out, I wasn't even sure if the mouse worked in the application. I just thought maybe they just didn't do mice interactions. I mean, it just didn't do anything I expected it to do. But it does, like, outside of that, it does do what it sort of advertises itself to do. Like, it views PDF files and PostScript files. And you can use the menu, although they look like buttons, so you won't realize it's a menu at first, but it's along the top, and you have to click and hold to get it to show. And you can zoom in on a page, you can zoom out, you can set the document to fit your window, either by height or by width, and all those kinds of things that you do with PDFs in a PDF viewer. If you do zoom in on a page, that's the one time you get to use your mouse. You can middle click, weirdly, to kind of move to scroll around that current page. The side panel also uses mouse interactions, to be fair, but just clicks. That has navigation tools, so it's got like a little table of content or a page listing over on the left. It's got the next page button and the previous page button are over there on the left. That was a little bit confusing because I kept wanting to just kind of scroll to the next page, but it would just never let me do that. Yeah, so it felt like a very old application. I can't imagine using it myself. In fact, I'm going to do a sudo remove pkg gv. And now I never have to look at that application again. I mean, not that it was that bad. It's not like it's not it's but I just realistically, I'm not going to use it. And absolutely, I think if I want a lightweight PDF viewer, which sometimes I do, XPDF is really just the way to go. Like that's a perfectly usable, perfectly fine little PDF viewer. GV, no, not for me. All right, next up is HexChat. HexChat is a graphical IRC client. I think I might have used it very briefly at a specific job, but I think even at that job, I eventually switched to the KDE one. Which one is that? Conversation. That's what it is. Conversation. But HexChat is quite nice. So you launch it and you enter your desired nickname, the nickname that you want to be seen as on the IRC server that you're about to connect to, and then you connect to an IRC server. There are several IRC servers out there. The default, it seems, is LiberaChat, which is kind of the or Libera.chat. That's kind of the successor to what used to be Freenode, but apparently Freenode got like hostile takeover or something, which I don't even know how that works, to be honest. Sounds like poor organization, probably. So Libera.chat is kind of the new place to go, and it is an IRC server. After you've signed on, you're in a sort of lobby area that's kind of typical for IRC. I mean, I'm kind of trying to assume you've never been on an IRC server. And you can choose which chat room or channel, as they call it in IRC, you want to join. So if you're new to a server, you probably don't know what channels there are to join. So you can go to the server menu and select Join Channels and then click Retrieve Channel List. I tried to go to the server menu and just go to Channel List, and that did not work. So instead, I went to Server, Join Channels, and then clicked Retrieve Channel List. And got a full list of all the channels on Libera.chat. From that list, you can choose a channel and then click the Join Channel button. This the window stays up, the channel list remains. So that can be a little bit confusing. But in your main window, if you make that, if you click over there, or if you close the channel list yourself, you'll see that the channel you've just joined has been added to the left column. That's the channel list. And then a list of users in that channel pops up in the right column. And then the big middle panel is where, predictably, all the chat shows up. That's where the chat happens. Well, it's where the chat plays. You type into the bottom text field, which is pretty obvious once you see it. It's like any other chat interface you've ever seen. Like you type at the bottom, it echoes what you've just said and shows all the responses that you get up at the top. IRC has its own set of commands as well, which largely you don't need to know because that's kind of the advantage of a graphical client. Like HexChat has all the commands that you would, well, not all, but no, maybe all, most of the commands anyway that you would maybe issue within chat. It's just in it's in a menu, so you don't need to know those commands. You can look it up though. There's a pretty robust list of commands that you can just type in IRC. You precede your command by a forward slash and then type the command and maybe some parameters, and then things happen. And it feels like you're chatting, but you're actually sort of chatting to the IRC server and issuing it commands, user commands. So it's a little bit, I guess, a little bit dangerous. Like back when I was on IRC a lot, it wasn't completely unheard of that someone would accidentally somehow, hit the space bar before hitting their forward slash. And so it wouldn't get parsed as a command and it would just show up in the room and you'd see what people were trying to command the server to do, which is fine normally, unless they were like trying to change their password and then now you know their password, that sort of thing. So you do, a little bit dangerous, probably arguably better as a menu item that doesn't get mixed in with your chat, but it is kind of cool to be able to have like direct access to just making your, you know, changing your experience based on commands that you just type quickly as you would a chat message. IRC has its own sort of lingo as well. I mean, most internet lingo is going to be recognized on IRC just like anywhere else, but there are some IRC specific like slang conventions, I guess, that you might see pop up as you're joining IRC. Like if you're getting used to it, there might be some things that you don't know what people are talking about, because they keep talking about a Nick serve and what the heck is a Nick serve, and well, you know, you'll eventually learn it. So the best way, I guess, to find out about that sort of thing is to actually use it. So if you've never used IRC, HexChat is, I think, a really, really great introduction to it. I've just described how to get started. I mean, you launch it, you define your nick, your nickname, you join a server, which are listed right there in the thing, and then you go to the server menu and join a channel, get a list of channels, and then start talking. You just start chatting. I think IRC is a really useful little communal chat tool. I think it's really cool. I think if I had more stuff to say to people right now, I'd probably be on IRC. I do have Element, but even that I don't really interact with all that often. So not that Element is IRC, it's not IRC, it's Matrix, but, IRC was quite good for a specific sort of mode of existence. Like if you're hanging out and just want to chat with people, IRC is a great way to find, a bunch of people who are likely more or less into similar things that you are into. I mean, it's kind of one of those self-determination technologies, you know, where because of what it is, because of its history, because of sort of its lack of prevalence on other operating systems, you just, in the end, you find a lot of Linux, open source, gamers, you know, just whatever you might be into, like your geeky hobby, that there's a chance that there's a bunch of geeks on IRC talking about the same thing, just because they're the ones who bothered getting on IRC. If that makes sense. Like it's kind of weird. I mean, that's not to say that you don't find those people elsewhere. You could find those people on other chat platforms as well. They're there as well. But you get the IRC crowd if you use IRC, which it doesn't seem like a revelation. But that said, I don't know. Somehow, I think because of the not difficulty, but it's a process to get started with IRC. So you do find a certain type of person who bothered to get on IRC, essentially. Or some people who were just on IRC and never bothered to get off. IRC is pretty cool, really. I don't know. Maybe I'll get back into it now that things are changing up for me a little bit with the winding down of the podcast and that sort of thing. We'll see. Very cool technology, though. Definitely worth checking out in general. And definitely kind of getting started, I think there's probably fewer better ways than something like HexChat or Conversation, spelt with a K, on the Plasma desktop. And it's just a really nice little gentle introduction. You don't have to learn all the commands or understand the structure of servers. You just open it. There's a couple of things that you have to go through to get started, but I mean, a lot less than I think most chat applications, to be honest. So, yeah, try out HexChat. And I think that's about it for today. That's a good 10 applications, I think, which I think I was very succinct about. I think I didn't go on for like half an hour about any one of them. So that was, I was impressed with that. These are all, as I've said before, in the XAP directory. I mean, there's just so many applications here that I use like on a daily basis that it can be difficult for me to be succinct about them, because I just want to chat and chat and chat about all the cool things that they do. And these have been great. Like, all of these applications, except GV, have been really, really fun to talk about. And I'm going to do that again next week. See you then.